Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac DeVere.
But I want to say one thing to the American people. I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people. Thank you.
We're going to try something different today, which I think you'll enjoy. While we're all thinking about the shutdown and looking ahead to the midterms, there's something else in the air. And that's the, in addition to this being the first anniversary of Trump's presidency, this is the 20th anniversary of President Clinton's impeachment. In a lot of ways, it's been a short 20 years politically. And there are many direct lines between what happened then and what's going on now. That Trump ran against Hillary Clinton is, in a way, the least of them. Presidential scandals, talking about sex and politics, questions about trying to force a president from office, changes in the media, the power of the internet, and how information comes out, the unbridgeable rift between what a lot of voters will believe or value, so much of it roots back to that moment. I wasn't around covering politics then, but our founding editor here at Politico, John Harris, was, right in the thick of it. And as he sat down to reflect on what happened for a story he was writing, taking stock of all of this, he brought together some of his colleagues in the White House press corps at the time, including Susan Glasser, who now hosts our Global Politico podcast, Peter Baker, whom you heard on Off Message over the summer last year in a discussion we had about the media and Trump, but was then at the Washington Post, and Michael Isikoff, who's now at Yahoo, but then was at Newsweek. And he spent a lot of time talking to Linda Tripp, among other people. I found this conversation fascinating, and though it's not like what we usually do, I thought I wanted to bring it to you. Turn over the wheel briefly to John. There's a lot of fascinating behind-the-scenes history in what they discussed, but also a lot of really interesting comparing and contrasting to what we're all living through now. Then we'll be back coming up with Steve Stivers and evangelical leader Tony Perkins explaining how he understands connecting his politics and moral leadership in Christianity and proudly supporting President Trump. Then more of a really amazing lineup with key players as this midterm year continues taking shape. So make sure you subscribe. Hit that button. I was just having dinner with someone the other night, and at the end of it, he pulled out his iPhone and subscribed right there at the table. I can't really recommend those kind of manners, but still, tell a friend, tell a coworker, spread the word. And let me know what you think about this episode and whether you'd like to hear more of it. Isaac@politico.com. And follow me on Twitter @IsaacDeVere. Like me on Facebook. All right, you got me up to 41,000 followers on Twitter, but come on. Help me get to 50,000. And now, talking the 20th anniversary of the Clinton impeachment. First voice you'll hear is John Harris, followed by Peter Baker, then Susan Glasser and Michael Isikoff.
20 years ago this week, Monica Lewinsky scandal breaks wide open. And for a certain group of us, it was a defining moment in our careers covering Washington. Mention her name? Mention that scandal to my children who were not yet born, and it prompts sniggers. And I think those sniggers and eye rolls, many people have those now when they think of that scandal. What I'm trying to invite people to remember is that in those opening days, it did not prompt laughter. It seemed really serious. The outcome seemed really uncertain. The issues raised about the presidency, about the media, seemed then, and I would say even now, seem profound.
I actually think we've kind of coming full circle actually back to that a little bit. The whole Me Too thing in the last few months has put this back on the table in a way that doesn't sound quite as sniggering as it has for the last number of years. After 9/11, a lot of people said, oh, look what they spent their time on in the 90s instead of focusing on real threats. And oh gosh, that was just a case of sexual McCarthyism gone amok or whatever. And I think today it looks a little different. Like we're revisiting in some ways what President Clinton did and what he was accused of in the light of Harvey Weinstein and Matt Lauer and Charlie Rose and all these others, Bill O'Reilly. And you hear some of the people who defended him, including people like Senator Kirsten Gillibrand saying, well, maybe actually we shouldn't have handled it the way we should have. Maybe we shouldn't have defended him.
Well, it's also a question of institutions. And I think the comparisons that are echoing for people right now are, as Peter correctly pointed out, the Me Too movement in Washington and the sense that the world has changed and that what seemed acceptable level of sort of, you know, sexual peccadilloes on the part of the president is actually something much more predatory and disturbing. But it's also about institutions, right? Trump poses these big questions about the nature of the presidency, what our expectations are for the office, what is the proper role of Congress or the media when the presidency seems to be out of bounds in some way. And of course, that is instantly what people recognize as the potential problems and threats when the Monica Lewinsky story first broke, courtesy of these great journalists here, Michael Iskov, Peter, and his colleagues at the Post, right? That was a question we were instantly confronted with that people forget. It wasn't so much, did he or didn't he do it with Monica Lewinsky, although that was certainly relevant right away. It was also the question of, and what are we supposed to do when the president lies under oath or he was accused instantly of suborning perjury? Remember, that was a phrase that we all learned in the first few days.
Michael, take us back, though. Give me a sense of yeah. that moment.
Oh, God.
Nobody yeah. was closer to the story than you.
Yeah.
And it felt fragile, right?
Oh, my God. It was it was crazy and mind-numbing. I mean, look, I had, through a weird set of circumstances, been aware of the Lewinsky relationship with Clinton for months. I had, you know, been talking to Linda Tripp. She had been telling me everything, not just about the late night phone calls and surreptitious visits. At one point, she offered to give me the blue dress, but also the efforts by the president and Vernon Jordan to get Monica Lewinsky a job, to help her through the Paula Jones lawsuit for which she had been subpoenaed. So I was aware this was, you know, a potentially big story, but, you know, we would talk about it at Newsweek. How would we ever publish this? How would we ever be able to prove that this was real? But then I get the phone call on a Tuesday, a slow day at Newsweek. There's this little event going on at the Ritz-Carlton. Tripp is having lunch with Monica, and Starr's got the whole thing wired. And I nearly fall off my chair. Starr. Ken Starr is on this? You know,
well, that's what makes the difference too, right? It's not a sex scandal at this point. It's the prosecutor who is alleging criminal acts that go beyond infidelity.
Absolutely. That's when I knew this was an earthquake, that this was Washington was about to explode. Because any way you cut it, this was going to be a monster story that would say as much about Ken Starr and prosecutorial excess as it might say, as it would say about presidential recklessness and mendacity. Those few days, 20 years ago, were, you know, as gripping and nerve-wracking as any I've experienced.
Just to take people back, and Peter and I both covered the White House at the time. Susan was our editor on many of the important stories. Before this, we did. Let's face it, we would gossip all the time about is Clinton strain? Is he not? What about this rumor? What about that? As kind of a recreational habit to pass the hours on the press plane or whatever. But we would, for the most part, never think about injecting that into our stories or making it a major subject of coverage.
In part because of the politics before then. It's not that it was a taboo subject, but that, in fact, it had been raised from the very beginning of Clinton's presidential campaigns, and he had won not once but twice, not because of, but despite this conversation that was ongoing about his extracurricular sex life. And so I think there was a feeling, right, that politically speaking, it was out there and the judgment of the public had been heard on it, right?
Yeah.
But the public didn't know what was true and what was not, just as we all didn't. That's why you would talk about it and gossip about it. But I just want to go back to something Peter said about looking back at this 20 years ago in the context of Me Too. You know, I got into this for a number of reasons, but, you know, one big reason was I had helped in the Post coverage of Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas. So when the Paula Jones allegations first surfaced, you know, my perspective was, well, if we took Anita Hill seriously, we have to take this seriously. And let's remember what the core allegations of Paula Jones were, that a state trooper summons her while she's on the job up to a hotel room to see the then governor, who proceeds to make sexual advances, drops his pants, exposes himself, and asks for oral sex. Now, who does that sound like when you hear it today? Mm-hmm. I think most people would think, oh my God, Harvey Weinstein. But that's what Paula Jones was alleging. So then the question became, was she telling the truth? And I spent a lot of time on that. And I, and the post went round and round about how do you handle something like this? I mean, you know, yes, she had come forward from political enemies, yet she had witnesses. The woman who was sitting next to her confirmed that the state trooper was there and took her down, and she came down and appeared shaken as she left when she
Michael,
left the hotel
We used to torture
room.
Ourselves, though, yeah, to be, well, what's the angle? Who paid for the state trooper's gas? Right. There's a public angle. We'd have to look at it. The sex is, of course, nobody's business, but the maybe abuse of funds are. And now we would say, no, sexual relations, as they reflect power relationships, are fair game.
And by the way, a lot of this journalism around Monica then, so flash forward to years, actually, not just months, but years of trying to figure out, was Paula Jones telling the truth? What I was struck by preparing for this conversation today, I went back and I was reading both the original fascinating Newsweek story, which was written by Michael, the original fascinating Washington Post story, which was written by Peter and colleague Sue Schmidt,
And Tony Losi,
who covered the federal courts at the time for the Washington Post. And I was really struck by, you know, there is a very, what seems now antiquated and very sexist characterizations of all of the women, in particular Monica Lewinsky, in those original stories. The questioning inherent in her veracity, in her presentation, her everything about her was considered to be fair game, from how she dressed and her lack of maturity and her own penchant for talking about sex with Linda Tripp. There was a deep vein of skepticism that she could ever possibly be telling the truth either to Linda Tripp or to anyone about this sexual relationship with the President of the United States. You know what really struck me reading those accounts 20 years to the day almost later? Everything Monica Lewinsky said was true. Mm-hmm. Everything that she said in those first stories, it took months and a national tumultuous scandal. And basically, she was exactly accurate.
I happened to be on Morning Joe the other day talking about this, and I was admonished because I slipped at one point and called it the Lewinsky scandal.
Oh, yes.
And I was
admonished that's
wrong.
And she's right.
And deservedly
yes.
so.
She's got a good point.
This was a Clinton scandal.
Yeah. And she
it was
did
not
tell the truth.
A Lewinsky scandal.
Well, part of the problem is we're trying to distinguish between Clinton scandals, right? You know, just to make clear, this is not Whitewater, campaign finance.
Right.
This is the you're right about that. It was this was a tough story to write. And obviously it was tough because Michael's editors were squeamish about it and weren't sure whether or not to go forward with it, because we had never actually accused the President of the United States, sitting President of the United States, of doing anything like this. Even the Jennifer Flowers things came out through a tabloid. It came out in a campaign setting. It was just different. And so it was not a small matter to put this in the paper, put this in the magazine. And I remember sitting in the office of Bill Hamilton, who was our national editor at the time, and Len Downey was there, and Susan was there, and Karen DeYoung was on the phone, and Sue Schmidt was there, and we were all discussing the story. By this point, we knew Michael had had a story. We knew it had been spiked. We had gotten the gist of it ourselves for our own reporting, and we were about to publish. And the questions that were being asked, though, were not, should we publish? It was, you know, what holes do we still have? What calls do we still need to make? How can we characterize this? What do we actually know? And what strikes me is that here we are 20 years later, flash forward, there's no way on earth a story like that wouldn't be published by the first organization that got it, right? Like Newsweek did hesitate, understandably, for good reasons, because they wanted to be responsible. But I'm not agreeing with them, right? I'm on your side on that one. But you can understand. I think it was a goodwill.
Yeah.
Right? I think they were trying to sort through tough issues.
Yeah.
And they made a wrong call.
Right.
But
they were squeamish. I mean, look, just to pick up on what Susan was just saying, you know, one of the arguments that was raised is, you know, well, what if she's just a fabulist? Yes. What if she's just making this all up and we go put on the newsstands for a week that, you know, the president is being investigated for this relationship and it turns out she's a complete flake.
Right. Which the Clinton people tried to promote.
Well, of course. Of course. Look, there was so much, you know, we had lots of advantages over everybody else, but the one that our biggest advantage is we did have the tape. We had listened to the tape that Friday night for hours into the wee hours of the morning and parsing every word. And I remember we just went round and round. One of the things that was in retrospect, there wasn't the explicit confirmation that Clinton had told her to lie, which was the core.
That's the core
basis
of the legal argument.
Starr getting involved. It was ambiguous. You know, I mean, there's an exchange where he says, well, has he told you to lie? No, he didn't tell me to lie. Does he expect you're going to tell the truth? Well, no, Jesus. Right. So what is it? And, you know, I suspect, you know, that accurately reflects the, you know, what actually happened, because Clinton, for all his recklessness and stupidity for getting himself involved in this situation, was smart in that sense. Mm-hmm. He knew how far he could go and what he
played
could not.
The, realm of ambiguity.
Yeah. One of the triggering events had not yet even occurred, which is what's fascinating, the element of entrapment in all of this. You said you listened to the tapes on Friday. It was not until Saturday, which is actually 20 years ago today, Saturday, January 17th, 1998, that Clinton went on a Saturday afternoon to give his deposition in the Paul Jones case. And they had the information.
About two blocks from here.
You know, exactly. And they had the information about Monica, and they asked him a series of questions. And Clinton, up until that very moment, probably sitting in the room, is when he realized
there's no way they're asking
right?
these
you know,
questions.
They've got the ring
if
you know?
They don't know.
Exactly.
They're
and then
way
he.
The lawyers blew it.
Exactly. And
the Jones lawyers
yes,
blew it.
That's
they,
right.
They relied on this, like, you know, tortured definition of sexual relations instead of asking specific
questions. Had
but
they
again,
said, did you do.
Again, out of a desire not to, you know, besmirch the presidency. This is a tough thing, right? You're asking people to say to the president of the United States, did you do this particular act?
But that's when the cover-up begins. It's when Clinton starts to, you know, realize he's going to have to lie even more in order to protect himself, that his secret is out. He calls Betty Curry. He cancels his going out to dinner, according to a very good account of this called The Breach, inside the impeachment and trial of William Jefferson Clinton.
On sale everywhere.
Well, if we're going to mention books.
Right here, Uncovering Clinton, A Reporter Story by Michael Isikoff. You can get
and
it.
And don't forget The Survivor by John Harris.
That's
which
right.
Is also
Everyone
a fascinating,
except for me wrote a book about this.
You were the smart one.
I'm torn, though. On the one hand, I'm hearing, I think we would agree, there's no way Bill Clinton could pass the test as it's prevailing currently against Senator Al Franken or against Charlie Rose, based on what we know of his behavior and the allegations against him, not just from Monica Lewinsky, but from a trail of other people on the record, Catherine Willey, Paula Jones. Wouldn't pass. He'd flunk the test.
Right.
Except there's no way that Donald Trump could also pass that test, and yet he seems to pass it.
Yeah.
What gives?
Good question. I mean, my instant reaction would be there's so much else with Trump that and so many other questions that, you know, might even be larger that maybe this one doesn't get as much attention as it should. I don't know. What do you think, Peter?
Literally the other day, on the front page of a couple of the papers is a story about the future president of the United States allegedly paying $130,000 to keep a porn star quiet about their affair.
This, 3 days later, and now it's in other news.
It wasn't even on the front page the second day.
Yeah.
And but because of Michael's reason. There's so many other things. Is he mentally fit? Is he saying racially inflammatory things?
Right.
Oh, and is he paying off a porn star? How do you process all these things in a 3-day period?
And
also
live with the Russians, right? I mean, you know, like.
But let's also say that the deck is still stacked against women. You know, there are no Women executive editors of these newspapers making decisions about what's important. There's a sense that somehow kind of like, well, Jennifer Flowers came up in 1992, but Clinton was elected anyways, that because the Access Hollywood tape came out, because these women, 19 women came forward and accused Donald Trump of various kinds of sexual harassment or assault even before the election, his claim and that of his supporters is basically old news or fake news, you know, that this is out there and he was elected president of the United States despite that.
I would say one of the unfortunate lessons too from the Clinton episode that other politicians, some other politicians may have internalized, which is that denial works. In Clinton's case, lying works. For 8 months or seven, 8 months, he basically says to the American people, no, I didn't have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. And then he finally admits it in the grand jury day in August of 1998. But by that point, the public was tired of it and sick of it. And they'd already made up their own minds about it. And it wasn't as shocking. Had the admission come from the very beginning, it might have been shocking enough to have forced him. Do you think this is right, John? Shocked him, shocked the public enough to have forced him to resign. But because he gave his supporters enough something to hold on to, it's not true, it's not true, it's a lie, it's mean.
Delay allowed him to change the question from did he do it, is that okay?
Yeah.
Or I think a lot of people would have said no. Now, yes, he did it, and no, it's not okay. It allowed him to change the question, in my view, to which side are you on?
Yeah.
And I would be very surprised, according to you, Hillary Rodham Clinton was one of the people who didn't think he had done it until his August admission. But I must say I was paying attention at the time. I didn't know anyone who actually thought he didn't do it after maybe the first 24 hours. It was obvious he did.
It was
obvious he did. But the question was not did he do it. The question was which side are you on? Are you on Bill Clinton's side or are you on Ken Starr's side?
Clinton, and Newt Gingrich and Hombele.
Clinton benefited from two things. One is, first of all, in addition to lying, he had a very aggressive set of defenders, media savvy, who would know how to shape his story, to go after his political enemies and frame it that way. And then he had the excesses of his political enemies, which, you know, who clearly went too far. Look, at the end of the day, impeachment is a political question. If the country is not with you, it doesn't make sense to move forward with impeachment. It was clear once the results of the 1998 elections came in and Republicans lost seats during a midterm that they should have picked up big gains, that the public wasn't there. But Clinton's political foes were so determined to get him. They were so infuriated by how much he had gotten away with that, you know, they took it to a step where they turned the country against him.
Michael, I want to challenge you, though.
Okay.
From what I think would be a Clinton perspective and picking up on Peter's point, you spent a significant portion of the 90s exploring what was, I think, obvious at the time, Clinton's personal frailty, his vulnerability to weaknesses of the flesh, his sex life. You spent a good portion of the 90s, and Donald Trump is exposed as writing a check to a pornographic star, and that is, we need 24, 48 hours to chew that over, and on we go.
Yeah.
That does not seem to jive.
I am not – but first of all, let me stop you. I reject the idea that my reporting was about his sex life any more than the brilliant reporting that the New York Times and the New Yorker and others have done about the abuses of powerful men towards subordinate women. That nobody says that was about their sex life.
Yeah, I agree with Michael on that. I think that's important.
That's the way the Clinton people wanted to craft it. You know, I was the guy on the bimbo beat. That was the way they could dismiss the legitimate questions about their boss's abusive conduct towards multiple women and his lying about it. So I think that's a very important point to make. But listen, on should Trump's more than indiscretions get more attention? Yes, of course. But as I said before, there's just so much with Trump that, you know, where does this rank? I mean, I would say it's up there, but does it trump, you know, the questions about whether he's, you know, mentally fit to be in office, whether he has the temperament to be president, whether he was in league with a foreign power in some way that got him elected in the first place? Those are, all, you know, huge questions that need to be sorted out as well.
I think there's two observations, one backward looking, one forward looking. I've always believed and agree with Peter that Bill Clinton's denial and how he handled the revelations of January 1998 were both the key to his political survival of the impeachment and trial, and also the template for future presidents who would face enormous scandal. I believe that Donald Trump has learned from and will take to heart the lessons of how Clinton survived politically the year 1998 and not only weathered this scandal, but did so for a long period of time with his reputation intact and even burnished politically. It was political genius how he handled it by lying. Lying was proven to work in some way that has enabled further the cynical and divisive political culture of Washington. I think that was, in hindsight, a key moment. And you talked about just the coverage of this. You know, all three of us, I'm curious what it was like at Newsweek, but, you know, John, Peter, and I all stood there in the Washington Post newsroom, I believe, when Donald Trump, when Bill Clinton gave that famous statement, and he said, "I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Monica Lewinsky." And that was a key moment in the presidency, right? That echoes forward to Trump. And just quickly on Trump, what I would say is that we don't know what we're going to face in terms of the Mueller investigation, in terms of how these various strands that Michael has mentioned, the Russia investigation, Trump's business dealings, how they play out, whether they come to a head in some sort of a political process on Capitol Hill or not. If they do, it may well be that an element we have not yet considered, but that they somehow merge with the questions about Donald Trump's character and comportment and behavior toward women. We haven't seen the end of the story yet, and it may well be because the politics are shifting that you could envision an article of impeachment that somehow makes reference to this conduct towards women.
I think the other thing that Clinton and John, you know, you've spent more time thinking about his psyche and his and understanding his sort of personality than anybody. Like most politicians end up being forced out because they feel ashamed or they don't want to live with the battering that comes with having their lives exposed or they think it might be unfair coverage or what have you, right? Al Franken, nobody forced Al Franken to resign except that Al Franken decided to resign. There's no process that required him to leave office. He decided to leave office. Bill Clinton refused. Democrats would have preferred in some way that he leave office because Al Gore would have been perfectly fine as a president. He would have been fine running into the 2000 election as an incumbent. Bill Clinton said no. Now, his supporters would say that was a heroic act on his part to resist the mob. But it also meant that politicians – Bill Clinton proved the point. They can't make you leave unless they make you leave. So don't. And I think Donald Trump is the same way. He's willing to live with all kinds of things being said about him in a way that most politicians would have either – you know, shame or say, no, and I'm not going to live with this crap or whatever. And it doesn't seem to bother.
We should probably talk a little bit about the dramatic changes in the news media and how that affects coverage of these scandals and how they play out. I mean, now we're in an environment where a news cycle is 15 minutes, right? You know, it's Twitter, it's you're on to one thing and then you're on to the next thing.
Your point is so important, the media environment now.
Yeah.
Then we believed in, and I think it was true, powerful platforms like the like Newsweek, like the Washington Post, like the New York Times, could set the agenda of what the consequences and relevance of the story would be. I think we, for myself anyway, I've long since surrendered that belief that any institution sets the agenda. The mob of a million arguing voices do their thing. Nobody sets the agenda. What would have happened if we were in the current media climate in 1998?
Well, let me just finish the point about the news media, and then I can get to that. So when Newsweek held the story, they were holding the story for a full week.
Yeah.
There was no Twitter.
Right.
In fact, although Newsweek had a dedicated AOL website. I had never even seen it. Nobody read it. It was there for the sole purpose of posting the magazine when it came out. We had never put a story up.
But then you
on
did,
the
right?
website.
And in
but
fact, that was a revolutionary that, moment.
Right, right. Right, right. So, right. you know, we have to sort of give the devil his due. Matt Drudge, you know, posts his little item on a Saturday night, big screaming arguments at Newsweek about holding a story about the president's relationship with a former intern. You know, then everybody's like, what the hell is going on? Everybody's scrambling. By Tuesday, you guys break the story. So it's out there. But we knew we had more than anybody else. We had the tape. I'd been talking to Tripp for months. The decision is made. We're going to post the story on our website. And it was like, huh? How does that work?
Right.
What do you do? You know, and we wrote, you know, a 10,000 word story, whatever it was. But since we didn't think anybody would even know how to find our website, we faxed the story around to news organizations all over town, you know, cranking out on a fax machine.
And the fax was the key instrument, the revolutionary technology at the time. Yeah. I mean, website thing, we all laugh at this. At the Washington Post, I had started work the week before as the deputy national editor for investigations. And the internet was considered a perk at the time at the Washington Post. And I did not actually even have access on my computer to the internet. And I was going to end up being like, you know, like overseeing this coverage. And there was an external basically drive that they would give you. And they said, well, we're really sorry, but we've given out all of those. So what I said, how do you get information? How do you access the internet? You know? And they said, well, you go to the library. They still have a library inside the Washington
Post. Exactly.
And it took, by the way, 3 weeks of, you know, lobbying and like the top editors of the Washington Post to get me access to the internet. In the meantime, the president of the United States has almost been forced to resign from office because of the internet.
Well, and this whole story, as it played out over the year, was a whole revolution in media, because you had the advent of Drudge, at least in a powerful public way. You had Michael's story first going up on the web. I wrote the first story ever appeared on the Washington Post website about one of the impeachment, you know, the step toward impeachment. We had Fox News, which really came into its own as a powerful force in politics in that year. All of these forces beginning to show how the media was going to transform ultimately into what it is today without social media, which has then taken that 3 or 4 or 5 extra steps.
Do you think it would have just accelerated the process and we all would have been on in different camps and so Clinton would survive in this environment, or would it have meant he would have the whole project would have erupted in flames within the first week?
I don't know. You had Fox News that was around. You had MSNBC, but it was not what it is today to defend Clinton. So, you know, it may have been worse for him if the technology was there, because would he have had the same access to defenders? I don't know. We'd have to.
Flip side is also Starr's investigation would have been completely different. You know, I was struck rereading the story, you know, Michael's excellent account of all the, you know, wiring that Linda Tripp did and the taping and stuff like that. She did that because she was concerned of being called in as a witness. She was concerned about her own account of her relationship with Monica Lewinsky being called into question. Well, of course, in the era of email and texting and Facebook, there would have been so much evidence that a prosecutor wouldn't have been able to gather very quickly. This need of the entrapment aspect of this would actually have gone away.
That's
because they would have
point.
Just had all the evidence.
That's right. There would have been text messages.
Yeah, of course there would have been. You know, and Monica definitely would have saved them. If she's saving the dress, she definitely would have saved like any.
She would have been texting Linda after every one of her visits.
Yeah, she'd been like, oh my God,
Clinton.
We did this. Yeah.
And it would have been right there.
But one of the things that Clinton did that helped ensure his survival is to make sure, A, he made it partisan, and B, he took advantage of the partisanship of his opponents, right? You talked about the opponent's overreach helping him out. By making it a partisan thing, he forced Democrats who didn't approve of his behavior, who might have abandoned him under other circumstances, to stand by him because they didn't want, as John said, to stand with the other guys. That has only gotten more so in 20 years by virtue of the media and social media and, you know, the increasingly balkanized, polarized environment in which we live in. Everything is seen through a partisan lens. And it's so hard to kind of get to that Nixonian era where basically Republicans were able to say, enough. We don't believe that this president belongs here, even though he's from our own party.
You had a little moment of that when Clinton finally came clean and admitted it. And I think Joe Lieberman gave that speech on the Senate, which indicated he was about to. Did he call for Clinton's resignation or he just?
No, but he basically was. It was, and Clinton was in Moscow, and I was with him at the time. It was an incredibly dramatic moment because Russia's economy was collapsing, and the president of the United States was being called out by his own party on the floor of the Senate. And this is where the Republicans lost an opportunity, right? They preferred to go for a all or nothing impeachment or nothing kind of attack rather than sitting together with the Joe Liebermans and the other disaffected Democrats, of whom there were plenty, and said, let's do a bipartisan censure or whatever it is and that will have an end result in which both parties spoke out and said, this is unacceptable. This is – we draw a line. We may not be pushing you out of office, but we don't think this is reasonable behavior by a president.
Peter, one part I don't agree with you about Bill Clinton is that he was kind of indifferent to the opinions or judgments of others, that he just compartmentalized and was sort of at peace with the sort of false story he had to project. I think it pained him greatly. And this is the difference with Trump. I honestly think Trump is contemptuous of establishment institutions, establishment voices, establishment precedents. Bill Clinton would prefer to be the presidency that he wanted would have been to have the acclaim of those establishment voices.
Yes, but
Bill Clinton cared what the New York Times editorial page said about him. I think, and he cared about whether he was a president being subpoenaed.
Yes.
Whereas I honestly don't think Trump gives a damn.
Yes, but go back to what I always thought was one of the telling moments after the scandal breaks, and it's the darkest days. Who does Clinton talk to? Dick Morris. Morris calls him. What are the numbers? Do a poll for me. And he's like, and Morris is giving him the numbers, like, wait a second. And Clinton's like writing them down. It was a cold political calculation. What could I get away with? Yeah. What can't I get away with?
Well, and John's point, exactly. Yeah. It's important.
He's a political creature.
He had to make a choice. And it's not that he was indifferent to the chorus of opprobrium around him. He clearly cared about that. He's a creature of the establishment. He flourished in it. He rose from obscurity to succeed in the institutions of American power, Yale University and Oxford and American politics. So he wasn't indifferent to it, but faced with a choice between that and his political survival, he chose his political survival. And in the end, we remember Bill Clinton as a gifted politician in part because he showed that he could overcome even a scandal such as this, right? Like, you know, he was gifted at politics, whether you think he was a good person or not. The evidence is fairly overwhelming on that, right? You know, what we have admired about him as a politician is that he's good at it, right? Or that he was willing to do the thing that was amoral but successful when it came to staying in office and surviving a scandal that was truly unprecedented. This goes back to your opening point. This was unprecedented. It wasn't merely chapter 87 in the crazy political scandals of the Trump era. You know, we might receive it very differently today because we've been living in a circus-like environment. This kind of circus in January of 1998 was not the world that we were used to living in. And it was seen as something that even for Bill Clinton, even though there'd already been lots of controversies, many of which didn't involve sexual harassment, this was seen as a level of circus and spectacle that defied our ability to categorize it.
At the table we're sitting at, there's an empty chair, and I'm just imagining that Bill Clinton was sitting at this chair. And we've all spent a lot of time listening to him and speculating among ourselves about him. What do you think he would say about this conversation?
You're the one who's – what's the phrase that Steve Bannon likes? You're the one who lives rent-free in Bill Clinton's head. I mean, what do you think?
I think he would agree with the part of the conversation that says there's a kind of a linear link between the politics of that year of scandal, 1998, and politics as it exists today. And I think he would feel deeply aggrieved that rules and standards and media assumptions that got imposed upon him are seemingly imposed with with no consequence, either not imposed or imposed with no consequences on politicians that follow, including Trump, and he'd be jamming his finger into the table or wagging it at probably your face, Michael.
he's done that before. Here's a question for you. Have we seen or heard much from Bill Clinton Mm-mm. ever since the Harvey Weinstein Mm-mm. scandal erupted?
He did something the other day on Facebook on Haiti. And that's about it, basically,
yeah,
right?
He has not been in public, no. Which is extraordinary when you think about it.
But on television has been Juanita Broderick, has been, you know, we yeah. have seen Kathleen Willey, yeah. Paula Jones, all these people are coming out and saying, well, Me Too, hey, we were the original
Fox
Me
just
Too.
Announced they're starting a whole series called Scandalous, and it's not about yeah. the Trump scandals, it's about Bill Clinton scandals.
Oh, yeah. Well, I kind of think that's pretty telling, actually. I think that Clinton, I mean, it must be killing him because yes. he's like, you know, such a public figure. How does he contain himself? But the fact that he is not out there saying yeah. anything, I think says a lot about how views have changed about the events we're talking about today.
Yeah. I felt that this has been the original behavior that caused this or led to this is still deeply unsettled in Bill Clinton's mind. And the evidence I have for that is his own memoir, which is those of us who have read it. Not everybody goes through page by page, but probably Peter, you and I have. It's almost an hour by hour account of his presidency. And then I called Tony Blair, and then I stopped to grab a Diet Coke or something like that. And in that TikTok of his presidency, Monica Lewinsky enters the story, not when they had their relationship starting in November of 1995. She doesn't ever get a reference in Bill Clinton's memoirs until this week, January 1998. Mm-hmm. And that to me said something telling, and I'd say also kind of sad. We have to remember that there are human beings at mm-hmm. the heart of this, and Monica Lewinsky is probably the biggest victim. She mattered not at all. Except the extent that she was thrown in this firestorm.
Yeah. Well, that does remind me of another telling mm-hmm. point from that episode, which is that I believe Monica testified that she was not sure, even after the first four or five times she had sexually serviced the president, whether he knew her name,
mm-hmm.
Which I think when you go back and what do we make of what was taking place in there, that gets into the power question.
By the way,
another
name we haven't mentioned in this conversation is that of Hillary Clinton. And we haven't talked about really Hillary Clinton. We haven't talked about Chelsea Clinton, also victims in this scenario. And fascinating the extent to which over the last year and a half, Donald Trump was able to use the story and to rewrite the narrative of Bill Clinton's scandal and his aggressive behavior toward women and pattern of lies and deception around that as a story about Hillary Clinton as his enabler, as his, sort of complicit in the destruction of, you know, the honesty within her own marriage, which is both a fascinating aspect of this. It's also an interesting and important footnote that arguably it was the Clinton impeachment scandal which gave rise to Hillary Clinton's independent political career. And
it's literally the day that he's being acquitted on the floor of the Senate after the trial, such as it was, that she's in the White House meeting with Harold Ickes talking about this potential
Senate race
in New York and which counties she might do well in and so forth. It was really that was like the prequel to the next story.
Well, let's finish up with some summary thoughts, and I'll start. I do think underappreciated is the extent to which this scandal, even though it sometimes prompts jokes and laughter and so forth in retrospect, and even at the time, recall Jay Leno, this was 2 weeks into it, he said, Bill Clinton's doing so well in the polls, he's already planning his next sex scandal. But beneath
good.
The jokes, it is a reality that this moment deeply compromised a very promising presidency. And in my judgment, it compromised a brand of Clinton politics for which there were big prices to pay. One of those prices was paid by Al Gore. His run for the presidency in 2000 was star-crossed for reasons that are largely his responsibility. But I do think the Clinton legacy was compromised, mm-hmm. And Al Gore lost the presidency. I do think Hillary Clinton's aura and her brand of politics has been compromised. This moment 20 years ago, January 1998, had big consequences, maybe more than are obvious, that continue to echo to this day. Mm. Michael?
I agree. There's so many sort of counterfactuals. If there were, alternative history, if Gore had won, if Hillary Clinton had won the election, what would this conversation be like with Bill Clinton back in the White House? And would the Harvey Weinstein scandal have broken if Hillary Clinton had won the election? I mean, there's so many different ways you can think about this. But I think bottom line, I think we do look at this differently than many people did at the time. There was always the question about, where would Monica Lewinsky rank in when they write the obituary of Bill Clinton? Would it be in the first paragraph, the second paragraph, the third paragraph? I think there was a point at which it probably would have been had dropped to three or four. I think it's now up there to like two and possibly in the first one. And that's no small thing. If you're Bill Clinton and people in the Clinton orbit.
Yeah, he had successfully for a while rewritten the history so that his was a presidency of peace and prosperity compared to what followed. And so by the time 2008 comes around and his wife is running for the first time for president, people look back quite fondly on the Clinton presidency. And they say, well, gosh, that was a time when we had 22 million more jobs and we were, booming and we had relative peace around the world. Now here we are, this quagmire and a financial crisis and all. So, and now we're back. We're back talking about this again. And it's a complicated thing. That's what makes it Clinton such a fascinating figure, both as a politician and a historical figure, because there is this sort of like the combination of promise and peril. His greatest strengths are also his greatest weaknesses that he brings. It's such a Shakespearean story for him to, bring all this upon himself and then define his enemies, both his tormentors and his, in some ways, his saviors. So he's going to be a story we're going to be writing about and changing the story in some ways for many decades to come.
Well, I think one of the reasons we're going to be changing the story that it feels that it's being up in the air all over again, how to view the legacy of this is that Donald Trump has caused us once again to reexamine or to open up the legacy of most of our recent presidents. And it's going to look very different if you had someone like Trump who remains in office and is untouched and is seen to have gotten away with accusations of a similar or even more serious gravity when it comes to attitudes and relations toward women over time. The story of Bill Clinton is now intertwined with that of Donald Trump in a way that just as the legacy of Barack Obama is now intertwined in our minds with that of Donald Trump. So until we know the ending of the Trump story, we're not going to know how to look at this chapter in Bill Clinton's presidency.
Yeah. I'm going to give you the last word because you were such at the, your story got spiked and given the really interesting points that, that Peter and Susan made, which is that what we think of the past is determined by other events and what follows. Do you feel now that your reporting, intensely criticized at the time, has been vindicated? Do you have any regrets about the whole episode?
Yes and no. Yes, vindicated, but although the criticism was unpleasant, I never had any doubts, nor did my editors, that we handled it in the right way. I'm sorry, the second part was in which I said no to was...
did you have any regrets? And do you feel that the reporting is held up over time, over 20 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think, we got it entirely right. What we published was, holds up. So no regrets on that score. I would like to end on one point. I just want to take you back to the Paula Jones episode for one moment. When I first started looking into that, the White House communications person at the time was George Stephanopoulos. And I remember I was asking him questions to try to get to Clinton's account of what happened. And Stephanopoulos made the point to me is, do you realize when this event with Paula Jones was supposed to have happened? It was the day after Bill Clinton flies back from Cleveland at the Democratic Leadership Conference, where he gave this rousing speech that essentially put him on the map as the probable front runner for the Democratic nomination. It was his highest moment in national politics. He was pumped. He could taste it. He was going to be the Democratic nominee for president of the United States. And what does he do the very next day? Stephanopoulos made the point that proves it couldn't have happened. Do you think he's that crazy? In fact, it's all there. At his moment of greatest triumph, he sows the seeds for the greatest debacle of his political life. And I think there's something very large when you talk about Shakespearean to say about all that.
Yeah, or Gatsby, born back ceaselessly in the past. Yeah. That's not all of us, though. Michael Isikoff, esteemed reporter, still on the beat. Your podcast, again, we'll give you another plug for
Skullduggery on Yahoo and iTunes and where everyone gets podcasts.
Peter Baker, White House correspondent, still after all these years, for the New York Times, and my colleague Susan Glasser, editor of the Global Political podcast, also available on iTunes. Hey, thanks a lot. This was a fun trip down a pathway into the past, and I do think it still has meaning. So appreciate you sharing your thoughts.
Thank you, John.
That's great.
That's great.
Really interesting stuff, right? Well, that's all thanks to Zach Stanton, who produced it and put that conversation together. Remember, coming up, we've got Steve Stivers, Tony Perkins, and many more. So subscribe. Catch you next time on Off Message.